The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moore, and greetings to all of you and to you who are listening in electronically today. Let's go over to Ezekiel 33. William Barclay is a very famous writer, and he said something that I read once that I thought was really fascinating. He said, there are two great days in every individual's life. And the first day is the day that they're born. And the second occasion is when they realize the reason why. And I think that is really profound. Which one of these days do you think is the greatest? Because I'm convinced it's the day that we find out the reason why we were born. And while he may not know it fully, you know, he knows a little bit, and even that impresses him. But what we know is so great and so grand that without this knowledge, I think life would be of little purpose. And when I think about it, in all honesty, our calling, my calling, absolutely amazes me. We find ourselves among all of those down through the ages who have been called of God to be a part of his family. And you and I actually know the reason why we were born. And we have the opportunity to become the very children of God. And to me, it's like beyond our imagination's capability to understand the fullness of that. But on the other hand, what we do understand is mind-boggling and inspiring and uplifting. And at this time of year in particular, the churches of God all around the world begin to focus on what it is that made this all possible, the Passover and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. He died so that we may live. And this is the beginning of something greater than anyone in this world has ever imagined or ever been. It's the greatest life-changing event that could happen to any one of us in this life. It's a chance to live again. It's a chance to live again on a level beyond our imagination. There are people that have died and they've had near-death experiences, and some have been actually died, they've died and been revived, and others have come very close to death, so much that they were very frightened and they were sure they were going to die. And this too is often a life-changing event for them, that once they come that close to death and realize that they have a second chance, it moves them to become better people, and they make sometimes very radical changes in our life. But perhaps you haven't thought about it this way. But the fact that you and I were called, and the fact that we were put in the water, and that our old self died, and we were raised up a new creature. And as a result, we actually have a second chance at life. We have that second chance on a much greater level. And in that context, I want us to think about this time that we're in now, and I want you to think about this statement about realizing the reason why we were born. We have a new chance in life, and in this chance that we've been given, this opportunity, we are to go another way. Ezekiel 33 and verse 10, where it says, therefore, O you son of man, speak to the house of Israel. Thus you shall speak, saying, if our transgressions and our sins be upon us and we pine away in them, how then shall we live? Well, you could put it this way, knowing that we've been called out of our sins and that we have been laden with them, how then should we live? And I believe it's Christ's sacrifice that it is that begins to show us the answer to that question. How should we live? We strive often to put sin behind us, to get rid of it. We think about that as these days come upon us and we de-live in our homes. And the point is that still, after a month or two goes by, or some time goes by, that eventually that we are pressured and we sin again. And we sin again and again. And Christ spoke, I think, of a similar situation. What is happening here? Let's go to verse 20, Matthew 12. Matthew 12. What is going on, and how can we do better? How can we improve our leaving sin behind? He spoke this, saying in verse 43 of chapter 12, verse 43. When the unclean spirit has gone out of a man, he walks through dry places, seeking rest, and he finds none. And then he says, I will return unto my house from whence I came out. And when he's come out, he finds this clean, swept, and empty and garnished. And then he goes and he takes with himself seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. Even so, he says, shall it be unto this wicked generation. And I remember years ago when Mr. Armstrong read this very scripture to us, and he asked us a really pointed question, and he said something in a way of an object lesson that I have never forgotten. And he asked us this. He said, what is the best way, if you had a milk jar and it was empty of milk, you know, what's the best way to get the air out of that? What do you do to get the air out? And he said, it's obvious. You pour milk into the bottle. You fill the bottle with something other than the air. And that's the point. We take sin out of our life, but we've got to fill our lives and our hearts and our minds with something else. We've got to put something in it. Fill our minds with something good. Let's go to Acts 10, if you will. Acts 10. You and I have this job to fill our minds, our hearts, our lives with something good. And I want to put it this way. Do all the good we can. Do good by every means we can. Do good by every way we can. Do good in all the places that we can. And do good to all the people that we can. And do good just as long as we can. I want you to think about this, that we should do all the works we can. We're to imitate Christ himself. And as he walked the earth, what was it that he did? He went about doing good. Acts 10, Acts 10 and verse 38. And it speaks here about God having anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power, who went about doing good and healing all that were oppressed of the devil, for God was with him. Then in Ephesians 2, it continues on. It tells us something that I think is very similar in Ephesians 2 and verse 10. There it says, for we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God has before ordained that we should walk in them. And we talked before about a people who at the end of time would be predestined to be a part of those people though who were called. And all of those people in this category are to do good works. That's why we were created. That's why we were born. And that's what we are to do. Deuteronomy 6, and of course, in verse 5, you know, we are being recreated in the image of God, and we're being created to learn in this life to do good works. Not to go out and just do good works for some kind of reward or something, but to learn to do good works as a part of the way we live, as a part of the way we think, as a part of our just natural personality, and we're being formed and we're being shaped and we're given time and God works with us and we work with him in a relationship for that very purpose, to learn to live as he lives. And he lives doing good works. In Deuteronomy 5, 6 and verse 5, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." That's what Christ did, ladies and gentlemen. That is how he lived every moment of his day. And he showed it by spending his life doing what is good every time, in every case. He was there helping others all through his life. Back to Ephesians 5. He contributed to the lives of others in giving himself to them, in setting the right example for mankind in just so many ways. And when we strive to do good, we're imitating Christ. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. We're going to eventually be formed to be like he is. He's going to change our vile body so that it's like his body. But we've got to first change our vile human nature by replacing it with that which is good. You know, it's so sad to me that I see our society today that has so much, and yet I see them as being a society that is very unhappy. I hear from Judy about the people that she works with and the trials they're going through that they shouldn't have to, and their marriages and their child rearing and the things that they face are just terrible. And here we are, though, a nation that has been so blessed beyond our wildest dreams. We have been blessed as a nation, and yet people are not happy. You know, there was a lady, it was a number of years ago, but I was talking to a lady, and she was telling me that she was depressed. And I told her, well, you know, why don't you go to a nursing home and start serving some individuals there? Because I did that for a while, and it really helped me see how blessed I am when I saw how others were living. And she got mad at me. She was angry at me and even started yelling at me that, you know, how could I think of such a thing when she's feeling down and so on. And she just didn't understand where I was coming from, that there is a life-changing power whenever we do good for others, when we give of ourselves or when we sacrifice for them. There is a life-changing power that is taking place there. And I say this, if we fail to connect with God in this way, if we remain this sort of independent, self-sufficient, alienated people that we are today, we're like dead men. We're hardly feeling at all. And I see everywhere I go now, I see people sitting at tables, young people usually, but they're sitting at tables. There might be four or five of them sitting at one table, and they're all on the phone doing something, playing a game, talking to somebody, sending a text, doing something like that instead of interacting with one another. I'm telling you, we are living in a time when the people, the young people especially today, are so alienated from one another. You know, if only people understood, if they only understood the will of God. And Ephesians 5 talks about this in verse 14. And he says, "Wherefore," he says, "awake you that sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise." Do you understand that he's talking about arise from the dead? Because Mr. Armstrong said years ago, I remember he said, that people just have a kind of life. They don't have real life. They just have the fact that they're living and breathing, and that's all they have. And so he's talking about people that are dead spiritually, that are dead, and even though they're alive. But rise from that. Christ will give you light. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but be wise. And then he says, redeem the time, because the days are evil. Wherefore, don't be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And don't be drunk with wine, where is excess, which so many people today are drunk with some sort of mind-altering drug that the government is supports in the pharmaceuticals to put out for us all. But instead, he says, be filled with the Spirit. That's what we should do. Speaking to ourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. And I know I've done this before when I used to work outside. I'd be walking across the roof and I'd be singing. And there's no question that God made it so that singing makes you happy. And when we're here at church and we sing out to God, if we sing out with all of our might and we sing out loud and joyfully, we will feel that happiness. We'll feel His Spirit in us. And He says, giving thanks always for the things, for all things unto God and the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And then he says, submitting yourselves to one another in the fear of God. And when he says submitting to one another, he means that we put ourselves in a position, I believe, where we are willing to help the other person. We submit ourselves to them, and we put ourselves at their disposal. And I think there is such satisfaction in doing this in the end. We ultimately enjoy being able to help other people. And this truth may start now, but I think it's going to last for eternity. And I've said this before, and I've put it in print, that God is building a servant family. Can you understand that? Can we picture that in our minds? A servant family where everyone is helping everybody else, where everybody has supreme value, and there isn't anybody excluded, and we'll help anybody anytime, every time, and we'll always make sure the other guy gets the best deal. That's the way to live. That's the way he lives. That's his way of life. Matthew 25. So we're to enjoy Him by doing good by all the means that we can. Matthew 25. It's the only way to live. It really is. And we should start living that way right now. You want to put sin out of your life? Put good things in it. Put right things in it. Put self-sacrifice in our lives. You know, often we think we don't have very much power to do very much in life, that we are not anybody to speak of. We may not be the most powerful people on life. But I do say this, we have an amazing power, and that power is the power of kindness. Just that alone makes a difference in our life, and it'll make a difference in other people's lives around us. We have the ability to do good all around us if we just look and we see it, you know. You know, if you're on a bus and you get up so that a lady can sit down, other people see that. It affects them, too, as well as the lady that you stand up for. And so God gave us, my point is, on a larger scale, God gave every one of us different abilities, different talents, and He expects us to use those gifts He's given us, and not just use them for ourselves, but to use them doing good to others. Matthew 25 and verse 15. Matthew 25, verse 15 through 29. So hang in there with me. But listen to what He says. And to one He gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability. And straightway he took his journey. And then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made another 5 talents. Likewise, he that had received 2, he also gained another 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth, and he hid the Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came, and he reckoned with them. So he that had received 5 talents came and brought the other 5, saying, Lord, you delivered me 5 talents, and I've gained besides him 5 more. And the Lord said unto him, well done, you good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I'm going to make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, you've delivered unto me 2 talents. Behold, I've gained another 2 besides them. And the Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Then he which had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew that you were a hard man, reaping where you had not sown and gathering where you had not strawed. And I was afraid, and I went and hid my talent in the earth where you have now what is yours. And the Lord answered and said unto him, you wicked, boy, I don't want to hear this. Don't want to hear this. You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reaped where I didn't sow and gathered where I haven't strawed. You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and at my coming I should have received mine own, but with usury. Take for the talent from him and give it to him that has ten. For every one that has shall be given, and he that has abundance. But from him that has not shall be taken away even that which he has. And then he says, cast him into outer darkness. But the point is this, that we have been given talents. And a talent isn't really a coin like I think many people think today. I looked it up and it was actually said it was 75 pounds of gold. Can you imagine that? That is enough for a person to live in that day for 19 years if they kept the Sabbath and didn't work that day. 19 years you could live off of that. Vast amount of money. But over time, the term talent came to mean whoever had a talent, that much money, was a privileged person. They had special privilege. They had come eventually to mean abilities. And so today we use the term as a talent as some kind of personality trait or gift that we have, some specialty, something we're better at than others. And so it's true, though. All of us have something to give, you know. I remember Mrs. Smith, the black lady. She's the sweetest lady you ever met in your life. She was 85 years old, and I'm telling you, she gave you a smile. She didn't have a lot to give, and she told me once when I invited her out, she said, well, Mr. Bradick, you don't realize at my age it's just so hard to go out and to go to services and go out too. She said, it just wears me out. I don't have anything. So think about, you know, we don't have anything to give. This lady didn't have anything to give. She made everybody happy around her. She made everybody happy because of her personality, giving of herself what she had, which was her love of God, smiling, her love of other people, and her gratitude to be in the church of God. But we all have something, you know. Some are thinkers, some are doers. Some are musical, you know, and some are artists. Some are mathematical, and some are skilled in writing or verbal skills. But you understand my point. We're not all the same. And in some of our lives, in various areas, we have talents that others don't. My point is, use the talents for good. Use the talents for good. Micah 6. Each one of those are God-given gifts that we have and that we have been given. And, of course, the reason we've been given them is to do good works. That's the whole purpose of having abilities, of having talents, of having things that we can do that others can't so that we can help them, you know, and help people in positive ways. There's nothing better in life. And this, I think, prepares us for the kingdom more than anything else, and I think it fills our lives with a sense of value and a sense of purpose that you cannot attain in any other way. And so we're to be do good with any means we have. And we shouldn't be afraid to offer help. Don't draw back because we think, well, we don't have enough ability. When we can go forward and we can help, then we should do it. And I remember once I was in the college there in the student center, and I remember somebody had an epileptic fit. All I had was a pen, and I put it in his mouth so he wouldn't chew his tongue. You know, and I'm not, you know, I mean to brag or anything like that. I'm just trying to think of issues that, as small as they are, how helpful they can be to others. And we don't always realize it. We just maybe do it at the moment and don't think. And it can be anything, as even as small as that, that we should not be afraid, you know. I want you to think just for a minute. Paul said he could do all things through Christ who strengthened him. Do you think we're that much different? Do you think we can't go through anything, everything that we might have to go through in this life? We can do anything. Things that we never thought we could ever do, we can do because Christ will strengthen us. Extraordinary things because of the gifts that God gives us and the help he'll give us along the way. And you know, when I read Joseph's story, I read about a man who was a slave in Egypt, who was thrown in jail. This guy had no chance for anything. He becomes the leader of Egypt. And Daniel, taken captive as a slave in Babylon, I believe, maybe stretching it or speculating, but I believe that when Nebuchadnezzar was out in the field for 7 years, who do you think it was? Do you think they had a power struggle there in Babylon for who's going to be the ruler? I don't. I think that it was Daniel who was the one that was running the show at the time. And when the king came back to life, came back to the senses, he just gave him the kingdom back in perfect order because he did good with all he could do. So you think sometimes these people would be in positions as slaves or as being in jail when they have no ability to do much of anything at all. But the reverse is true. There's never a case where we don't have the ability. You know, and I remember that one book that was written, I forget the author's name, but he was a psychiatrist that was put into a concentration camp, and he was alone once sitting in a corner, and he was naked after being tortured. And I remember he said he had come to this conclusion that no matter what other people did to him, no matter what they did, they could never touch who he was. They could never touch his mind. And so he would take his mind and go do good works with it. He would go into like almost a dream state when they tortured him. And after a while, the guards came to respect him, and it didn't take long before his doing good for others started to spread, and other people throughout the entire concentration camp, other people began to pick up on that, and they began to treat the guards with respect and each other with respect. Instead of trying to get what they could and looking and turning into animals, they became a different people, and they changed the whole camp. And it's written down historically. It's a marvelous story. But my point is, no matter how small we think we are, no matter how limited we think we are in our abilities or our powers, there's always occasions to help others. There's always occasions, whether it's just a smile or a good morning, or, you know, people today walk down the street and they feel unnoticed, they feel uncared for, and if you just smile and say hi, it can make their day. Something that small. Somebody noticed me in this vast world. You know, it means something to people. But there's so much we can do. So anyway, the formula to me is fairly simple. And it's, how then shall we live? How then shall we live? And the answer is, do good as many ways as you possibly can. Help people in need. Sometimes just listen to their story with real concern. And they are moved by it. And sometimes they catch messages out of their own story. And they can determine that they're going to be better, you know. Just trying to understand someone else's point of view makes them a changed person sometimes. We all have some means, as little as possible. We may think we still have some means, you know. We can mow somebody's lawn when they are sick and they can't do it. You know, we can send a beautiful note and a poem, as was done to Judy this week. And she was very deeply moved by that. And we can make a difference. And the way we make a difference is by striving to do good. Micah 6, verse 8. He has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. And I'm telling you, in this world, it is a mass of egos everywhere you go. Someone's trying to sell you something, trying to sell themselves, act like they're somebody bigger than they are, and yet he's telling us to be humble and do good. And I remember the story of President Lincoln when he was running for president, that there was a man that was named Stanton, and he hated Lincoln. And he wouldn't stop ridiculing him. He wouldn't stop mocking him. He wouldn't stop just attacking him in every way possible. And all over the nation, he wrote and sent flyers belittling Lincoln. And he wrote this, if you can imagine it: "You would not want this tall, lanky, ignorant man as your president." Think of the attitude this man had. But after the election, Lincoln became president. And he made up his cabinet, and he went to his advisors, and he was asking counsel, and he said he wanted to make this man over the state of war. And they all said, "Oh, no, have you seen what he's written about you? Have you heard what this guy said about you?" And Lincoln said, "He's the best man for the country. The best man for the country. He's put his own personal feelings aside, and he brought him on and put him over the army." And he said, "Because he's the guy that will organize that army, and he'll get the job done the fastest and save the most lives." And so he put the man who hated him in that position. Later, Lincoln was shot, and this man went over to where he was. And Stanton came to him, and at his death, he stayed with him till he died, and at his death, he gave a speech of enormous praise, and here's one sentence: "There lies," speaking of Lincoln, "the most perfect ruler of men the world has ever seen." You see how that changed him? But you think we don't have the power to change people by loving them, by trusting them, by respecting the abilities that they have and seeing them as valuable? We do have that. You know, we're not President Lincoln. We don't have the power he did. There's no question. But my point, we do have some power. And use that power to do good. Do good in all the ways we can, Matthew 5. Do good in all the ways that we can, under every circumstance, no matter what it is. Do good in all the ways we can. Matthew 5, a famous scripture there I want to pick up on. There is something greater than our feelings. In the world, we may not have friends in high places. True disciples of Christ, though, are good to those who even might be capable of hurting them. Matthew 5 and verse 44. And he says this, or he says in verse 44, "I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you." Why? Why? "That you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For as you love them which love you, if you do that, what reward do you have? Don't even the publicans do the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what you have more than others? You just do what the publicans do. So be therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." And so this is an aspect of God, that who is love, and he so loved the world even before we had changed, before we had been inspired by him, before we tried to do good, he still loved us. And why do we love him? Because he loved us first. That's the way it works. If we love others, if we show love to others, even people who are our enemies or seeming enemies, they can come to love us. And so we can pray for others, and we can make a difference in all kinds of ways and all kinds of lives. You can, and you should, and you must make that difference. You know, it helps you see things from the other person's side sometimes when you help someone that's angry at you or would like to hurt you. You understand what's going on with them, and sometimes it's terrible trauma at home or at work or something like that. But it often ends in reconciliation, and I say it ultimately, in many cases, is going to lend itself to eternal friendship with people in the kingdom of God. You ever seen boys, you know, young boys? They're fighting with each other, and eventually they become friends. That's what it's kind of going to be like, I think, in the kingdom. The people that we had trouble with will look to us with enormous gratitude, and we may be friends with some of them for the rest of all eternity. But here, and in other churches of God, people cook food, you know, so that we can have something to eat for Sabbath. That's not a big thing, but it is doing good, isn't it? And it helps us to kind of merge together, to kind of identify with one another and become bonded together in love, even during the Sabbath service. And it may seem like a small thing, but it does help, and it is meaningful, and it does count. Because he said, whoever gives a glass of water, it's going to count. Every good work counts, everything we do. And so sometimes you can help people, and you can get them over the first step. You know how it's just hard for a baby to get over that first step? After they make the first step, they can crawl up the stairs. But learning how to get over that first step is very difficult. And I remember that time when you had to come over and I had that tractor and I had that belt. You remember that belt? Have you ever seen in your life a more tangled mess of, I mean, whoever designed that thing? It must have been drinking a lot that day. But anyway, it just twisted itself in figure eights all around. I could not figure that out. But Terry came over and went through the directions with me, and we figured this thing out. Well, now I can do it myself. I got over that first step. But without Terry, I would still be there, out there in my driveway. You know, my point is, look at how help spreads, you know. And I want to help people when I can, you know, because people have helped me, and I think it's just a beautiful thing. And helping people get over that first step. Even work can be fun, you know. I remember when I was dating Judy, it was really funny that she wanted me to fix up this downstairs room I had, and so we were going to wallpaper it, you know, and we got all the materials, we went shopping, got all the materials, we went out, we did all the work, we came and we just made this wall all wallpapered, and I came down the next morning, and it looked like this thing had like a 3.5 foot blister. It was just pulling away from the wall. It was the funniest thing. So anyway, I called her, and she came over and looked at it. We had a great laugh, and we still remember that. But it was so much fun. We got it straightened out and did it. But it's just a memory in our life that we can share that is really fun. So work can be fun. So, we're to do good in all the ways we can, by the means we can. We're to do good in all the places we can. We may not be the president of the company, but we do have responsibilities where we work, whether it's at home or whether it's at the office or at a factory. We have responsibilities in our home, every one of us, and our men, we have responsibilities. You know, how many times have I heard that women say that he never picks up his socks? He just takes them off and leaves them lying there. Well, let's pick up our socks. Let's do something good at home. And it changes us, and it changes the way others relate to us. We have responsibilities towards our mates. Why? Why don't we give them what they ask, what they need? Why? Because I know people don't. They don't give what their mates need. I'm saying do good. Do good at home, do it at work, and do good to our children. Think of them. Put yourself back in their shoes, you know. Little children of God is what they are, on loan to us. They're not ours to do with as we see. And then there's friends that we have. There's neighbors that we have. There's people that are hostile to us. And we can be kind to them and show them the love of God. And so we are to, in our calling, to do good wherever we find ourselves. And sometimes, like Paul said, we have to overcome evil with good. in our Christian life, I have no problem saying this, is useless to us if we haven't learned to do acts of selfless service. And so we're to do good to all the people we can. And it was heartbreaking to me when I read about it the first time there. And that was that this girl was at Walmart and she was stacking her shelves out of the boxes that come. And at the bottom of the box, she found a note. And it was from a man in China, and he was explaining on the note how he had to work long, strenuous hours, how they beat him, and they paid him $1.60 a month. And he even put down his billet number on there so they would know it was authentic, hoping someone would see it and hoping someone would do something about it. And what do you think happened? They're still buying it. They're still getting the cheapest price. They're still making tons of money. Don't you see how that's the opposite of God's way? They could have gone to them and told them, this has to stop. We don't care how much money we make. This has to stop. We don't need to make all that money. They're rich already. But you understand my point. There's things in life that we can do also when we can help other people. And we should do those things. We've got to realize the value of human life. And the only thing that counts is doing good to others. Respect and do good to all people in all places, whatever their race, whatever their status is in life, we should help them attain their potential. And finally, we are to do good as long as we can. Keep doing good as long as we can. And I remember Mr. Hovey, and he was dying in a convalescent home, and I went to him. Used to visit him all the time, but he got weaker and weaker. But he was always trying to be the host to whoever visited him in that old convalescent home. And he would always try to be graceful and gracious as people would come to visit him. And so I had the chore of visiting him. It wasn't a chore after a while, but I remember the last day I visited him, and he was getting weaker and weaker, and that one morning he was dying, and he did not have the strength to even chew his food. And I said, "Good morning, Mr. Hovey." And he looked up at me, and he opened his mouth, and he tried to say something warm and greeting, and he didn't have the strength. And I could see the morning's food was still there. He didn't have the strength to chew it. But you understand my point? Right up to the end, he was trying to do good. To the very end. And I just, in my mind, when I went home, I went and prayed about Mr. Hovey. And in my mind, I could see him glorified in the kingdom for the kind of man he was. He would always try to do good. But this is the mind of Christ. To do good until the very end, to never stop doing good. And he went about doing good, and he gave to others when he was tired. He gave to others when he was sleeping in the boat. He gave to others when they were angry at him. He gave his life for us, no matter who we were, how well we were, or good we were, or not good, no matter what. Matthew 26. Finally, it came to his last day. Finally, it came to his last day on earth, the last day of his life, and it was the Passover night. He knew exactly what awaited him, and he knew that he was going to be betrayed by a friend. And I've been betrayed by friends, and it hurts very, very much, but never a betrayal that ended in my torturous death. Matthew 26 and verse 21. Matthew 26, verse 21. And as they did eat, he said, "Truly I say unto you, that one of you shall betray me." And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and they began, every one of them, to say unto him, "Lord, is it I?" And he answered and said, "It's he that dips his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me." And then he said, "The Son of Man goes, as it's written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had never been born." Then Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, "Master, is it I, and he said unto him, you have said. And so Christ explained to his disciples what was going to happen to them. And he had been telling them all along through his ministry, but they didn't really get it. It never occurred to them. They thought he was going to come and restore the kingdom, and that was their hope. In verse 26, and as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and he blessed it and broke it, and he gave it to his disciples. And he said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup, and he gave thanks, and he gave it to them, saying, drink you all of it. This is my blood in the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. And so he gave them these symbols, and they, of course, had no idea. And here he was, knowing that they didn't have any idea, explaining to them, I am going to have my body literally ripped apart for you. I'm going to spill my blood for you. And he knew that was going to happen in just a few hours. In verse 29, but I say unto you, I will not drink henceforth of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. And that's going to be a glorious time. And if we make it, if we learn to do good all the time, and if we learn to do good to the end, we're going to eat and drink with him. We're going to have some of that wine with him then. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and then said Jesus to them, all of you shall be offended because of me this night. Just imagine that. Every one of them would betray him in their own way. For it's written, I'll smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad. But after I'm risen again, I'll go before you to Galilee. And Peter answered and said unto him, though all men shall be offended because of you, yet I will never be offended. How many times have you and I ever made a commitment to God? And we said, I will never do this, and then we do it. I know all of us have made commitments to God that we failed to do. And this is an example of one of our brethren who did this. Jesus said unto him, truly I say unto you, this night before the cock crow, you shall deny me thrice. Three times. Sometimes I wonder in my own mind, how in the world could they have betrayed him? But the more I think about it, the more I have to ask myself, haven't we all betrayed him at some time? Haven't we taken the Passover and made a commitment one way or another to be better people and then not been better people? That we've let some commitment we've made to him slide because it wasn't convenient for us? Finally, they bound him. They came, the soldiers came, he was betrayed. The soldiers came and bound him and they took him to the high priest, and there they pulled out his beard, and there they spit on him and mocked him and hit him and beat him and so on. And then he was finally sent to Pilate, and there he was beaten repeatedly by a professional lictor. And what they would do is they would beat a man and beat a man and beat a man until he finally was unconscious, and then they would throw water on him and revive him, and then they would beat him again until he was unconscious again. And they knew, because they were professionals, how far they could take him. They could take him to a point where his breathing would show that if they hit him anymore, he'd probably die, and they'd take him right to that point before he would still remain alive, before they ever stopped doing it. And so his flesh was ripped off of him. Luke 23. The people were all crowded around when he was facing his opponent there, his antagonist, Pilate. You imagine that, saying, you know, don't you know I've got the power of life and death over you? And someone saying to you, looking you, you're the guy who's the ruler of the whole place, and looking you right in the eye and saying, you don't have any power unless it was given of God. You couldn't touch me if he didn't allow it. You know, that man was really amazing. Christ had so much faith. I just am so impressed by that. But here he is now, surrounded by a crowd of people, and I bet anything there were people in that crowd he fed. I bet there were people in that crowd that he had healed. And here they are now, just like we are today. Everybody wants to be on the winning team. Everybody wants to be the, you know, all the media's gathering together in one force, in one direction, you know. Just like everybody wants to be the accepted ones. We don't want to be different. We don't want to stand out. So everybody's going, crucify him, crucify him. Yelling at the top of their lungs to crucify this innocent man. And so they did. They nailed him with spikes to a stake. And then they took that stake and they raised it up and they dropped it into a hole and it landed with a thud. And when it landed with a thud, it just ripped and tore at the nail in his wrists and his legs. And his body hung there where he could not breathe unless he pressed up on the nail. And you can just imagine the pain that would feel to try to rise up with a nail in your feet. Just so that you could get another breath, another gasp of oxygen, another breath of air. And then they gave him vinegar to drink as the people taunted him. And here it was. It wasn't a king. It wasn't a prince. It wasn't a mayor. It wasn't a president. This was the creator of the entire universe. This was the God they thought they worshipped, that they were doing this to, and they were mistreating in this way. He could command angels, 100 angels, to come down and just devastate these people. He could rain down hail, fire, and brimstone and annihilate that place like an atomic bomb. He had that kind of power, but he didn't. He humbly submitted, and he did it for a reason, because he was doing good. For us. He was doing good for us. And so here was the very God they thought they served there, and they were treating him like this. But he was not finished yet doing good. As long as there was life in him, this great king of our universe was doing good. Luke 23 and verse 33. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they crucified him. And the malefactors, one on the right hand and one on the left. And then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots for it. Can you imagine, after all this betrayal, after all the pain, after the shock to his body, Christ said this, forgive them, Father, with his last dying breath. He's saying, forgive them. And then he's crying out, even facing God, forsaking him. And I know sometimes we feel like God forsakes us and he's not there for us, but he is. You know, and my point is, he had to feel the same thing we felt so he'd be tempted in all ways that we are. And he felt everything we feel. And he's an amazing being, our older brother, and he's one that we wish, one we really wish we could be like. You know, often the younger brother will, or the younger sister will want to be like the older one, you know. 1 Corinthians 13, if you will, 1 Corinthians 13. How then shall we live? Well, do all the good we can. Do all the good in any way we can. Do all the good with all the means we can. Do all the good whatever place we find ourselves in. Do all the good until the end. Keep doing good and never stop. You know, that said, I know I'm not where I should be. I know that. I'm acutely aware that I should be a better person than I am. But thank God I am not where I used to be. With every coming Passover, there is improvement. There's growth. Little pieces here and there are cut away, etched away like a sculptor sculpting something. And a chip here and a chip there of my rottenness is chipped away. And I only know what I know. And I only have the hope that I have because of God's calling, which is so good. And I know from his example, and I know from what his apostles left us, this. In verse 4, love suffers long, and it's kind. Charity or love, it doesn't envy. Charity doesn't vaunt itself. It's not trying to show how important they are, how much I know. It's not like that. It's not puffed up. It doesn't behave itself unseemly. It doesn't tell filthy, rotten jokes. It doesn't try to be the life of the party. It doesn't seek her own. It's not easily provoked. It doesn't get angry at every little mistake somebody makes. It doesn't think evil. Rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, and it believes the best of all people. It hopes all things, and it endures all things, believes all things that are the best of a person. You know, don't think everybody's a liar. Trust people. Hearing this, how, again, I ask, shall we live? You know, we're going to strive to put sin out of our lives. As we de-leaven our houses, we're going to be reminded of this lesson. Putting the leaven out is a type of putting the sin out of our lives. And we should start this year in earnest. And we should make a difference this year. And I ask you, why? Why is this year going to be different? And it reminds me of a story I want to tell you as we end this. A boy asked his father, he said there were three frogs and they were all sitting on this limb that was perched over a pool. And the son said to his father, why, one of the frogs decided that he was going to jump into the pool. How many frogs do you think were on the limb? And the father said, well, two. And the son said, no, three frogs were on a limb and one decided that he was going to jump in the pool. How many frogs are on the limb? And he said, oh, I get it. They saw him jump, and they all jumped with him. And his son said, no, there were three frogs on a limb, and one of them decided to jump in the pool. And he said, oh, he never jumped. He just decided he would. He wouldn't actually jump. Well, this year we're going to take the Passover and we're going to make commitments to God, aren't we? We're going to make decisions about how we're going to live our lives. Are they just going to be decisions, or are we going to put them into actions? Are we going to use our life to do good to the very end?